The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the interview.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 128. My special guest is Nir Yaniv. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
So you're Nir. Oh, yeah. Are there? Well, you're calling from all the way on the other side of the world.
Yeah, something like that.
All the way in Tel Aviv, which is a first for this show, by the way. Never had anybody.
I think there are several other guys here who might get your attention at some later stage, but yeah.
Oh, well, that's good. That's good. I hope so. I like the idea of having people on this show who are writing from very different parts of the world. We don't get as many of them as we would like, but it's refreshing, I think. So your new book is The Love Machine and Other Contraptions. It's out from Infinity Plus. It's basically in every format you can possibly imagine. And you have actually written some work with Lavi Tidar, who's also been on our show. You've written in particular two novels. Where did they go?
The novels... one of them is called Fictional Murder,
mm-hmm.
And it was written in Hebrew, and it was published in Hebrew, and one day when I'm really, you know, when I really have nothing else to do, I might translate it into English, and it's actually not science fiction and not fantasy, but it's a murder story, crime story, which occurs in a science fiction convention.
Oh, fun.
In an Israeli science fiction convention. Now, of course, there have been some books in the past dealing with the same subject, but not in Israel. I mean, you may be familiar with, how was it called? Bimbos of the Death Sun. Have you ever read that? No, that's a real book. I kid you not.
No, I've never read it.
No, it's... look it up. Look it up. It's about the murder in science fiction convention in the U.S. So we didn't copy the book. We did our own thing, but we had that in mind. By the way, Asimov at the time, Isaac Asimov, did a murder book inside a writer's convention. Not anything science fiction related. But it was called Murder at the ABA.
Oh, really? Like
also worth your time. Very nice book. So in our case, actually, the most compelling feature of the book, especially to Lavi, was that the first science fiction writer to be murdered in the book is myself. I mean, he loved it.
He loved killing you off?
Well, he did. Who did my killing? Who did? Yeah, he did. He got to kill me. Yeah. I think he did. No, or maybe it was. I forget now. Now we write it chapter by chapter. I don't remember who did what. Was several years ago. Anyway, that's one book, Fictional Murder, which one day. And the other book, the other novel, is called The Tel Aviv Dossier, and it was written in English. It was published by Cheezine Publication in Canada, and it's available on Amazon. And it's a crazy post-apocalyptic story, which occurs in present-day Tel Aviv, which gets attacked by weird, really weird supernatural forces. And you know, I'm not really. I mean, you know, you've probably interviewed many science fiction writers, fantasy writers, and they have all been, I bet, really nice guys and modest people and stuff. And I'm just not modest, you know. I don't have that feature, as Lavrie, by the way, will happily tell you. So I can safely say that the Tel Aviv Dossier is not only the craziest fiction I wrote, it's, I think, the craziest fiction I've read. I mean, if that's not enough for you to go and get the book, I don't know what is.
Well, I definitely do want to read it. I didn't know about that particular book until I saw a random tweet with your name in it from Lavrie. And then I realized you had a new book. You had a book coming out that this collection. And then I realized there's this other book, and it's like, wait, now there's all these other things I need to read. So
yeah, you got a reading list to do. You got job to do, man.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. So, and I was really happy to get a chance to read this, the Love Machine and Other Contraptions, and now I'm going to read that at some point too. So, and hopefully, if we get an English translation of Fictional Murder, that would be great.
Yeah, I do hope that I get the time to do that. But anyway, the thing I liked the most, you know, in the there were two pieces of criticism about the Tel Aviv Dossier, which I really liked. One, in one review, someone called us two young angry Jews. I love that kind of stuff, really. And in another one, someone said, it has been 2 weeks since I read the Tel Aviv Dossier, and I still don't know whether I love or hate the book. Which is, you know, that's the best you can get, I think. I mean, the guy is still 2 weeks, you know, afterwards he's thinking about the book.
And tormented by it, apparently, in a positive way, in the sense that he's still thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's actually a really, really good thing to hear about a book. If people are still thinking about it weeks later.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was that. And and now I have this new story collection.
Yeah. So why don't we actually talk about that? So it's hard to describe because it is it's got a wide range of different kinds of stories. Many of them connected by these kind of little vignettes of various contraptions. So there's like there's a one called the love contraption. There's another one that's a light machine. And there are other different ones that kind of are broken up in between there. But I noticed that there is a theme among many of the stories, which is somehow a piece of technology, and I'm using technology rather broadly, becomes the kind of the thing that changes the story. So you have one that involves a time machine that works by a record, or you have one of the funniest stories I think in the whole collection, which is an individual who gets this semi malfunctioning veggie detector machine.
Yeah, VegiScan.
So I was wondering what for you became the impetus behind writing these kinds of stories in which some sort of central piece, either a technology or a power or ability, becomes the thing that guides what happens around it.
Well, I have to say I just love machinery. I mean, not you know, I wouldn't like to have a factory at my home or anything like that, but I love the concept of it. I love the old films in which you see the I don't know, the 19th century. I love the image of the 19th century scientist, you know, sitting at home. That was a time where you could have made a major scientific discovery at your home. You know, checking that the frog leg moves when you put some electricity into it and stuff like that. Today, scientists work in huge installments, in huge places, or in universities, in huge labs. And that's, I know it's a bit, you know, it's a bit of a romantic tendencies, romantic area. But I love the image, and that's one thing. Now, the stories in the collection have been written over a period of about 10 years or so, maybe a bit more. So it wasn't as if I, you know, I went to work knowing that I have a theme of a common theme to the collection. These are, of course, not all the stories that I wrote in those 10 years. So when I came to having to collecting the stories, to having a definite collection that I want to have, I like to have themes. I love themes in everything that I do. I'm also a musician, so my two albums were theme albums. And I love to listen to theme albums, and I just love that. I don't like collections which are just, you know, let's find some random things, or, you know, oh, that's a story I once wrote, and that's, you know, that's just another, and there's no actual connection between them. I love that kind of connection because I think it adds more to the stories. Hmm. So when I came to collect the stories, the first one I thought of was The Love Machine. Not the short one, the long one.
Yeah.
There are two love machines. One is the story love machine, and the other is the contraption, several sentences of love, the other love machine. So that was the first one I thought of, and that led me to having the machines as the theme of the collection. And that made me make choices, you know, as to which stories to publish. And another thing is that I think that we are machines, not in a bad way, not that we work in what you'd call mechanical ways, though sometimes we do. But here my English fails me. I think to an extent, is that the right word?
Extent, well, yeah.
Yeah, so to an extent, we are all machines. So that's not to say that every story about people is a story about machines, but I think sometimes I try to have a look at the mechanical side of the person or the interaction between, you know, what the person is, the human side, let's call it, and the mechanical side.
And that actually makes me wonder about the story Cinderers, which is, I think, one of the more disturbing stories, and in the sense that its theme is, this person who essentially is kind of, we assume, is mad, but has done really awful things, presumably for his own entertainment, in the sense that he's just killing people. And in his delusional world, he's killing people to record the sounds of the fire and the explosions. But his conscience is in the form of this demon that is trying to convince him, like, you're murdering people. And there's a point in the story, in this really disturbing moment, where he says, they're not human. And I really was curious about this because it does, in some sense, kind of go to that question of the kind of machine nature of humans, that we do these things all the time where we dehumanize other people in order to justify why their deaths are irrelevant to us. And I don't know if that was an intentional theme on your part, or if you were exploring some sort of other dark underbelly of human beings, of their compulsions.
Well, that was one of the things. I mean, I remember when I first got the idea for this story, it came to me following a memory. You know, many times there's a trigger or several triggers for writing a story. So one of the triggers was I remembered the first time I heard of the concept of a Turing machine. You know what a Turing machine is, right?
Yeah, is it to test artificial intelligence?
Yeah, so if you basically, I'm simplifying it, but basically, if you have no idea that the person you're talking to is a machine, say if you use voice only or keyboard only, if you have no idea that it's a machine, then the machine passed the Turing test. So there was some kind of argument between scientists about that, and one scientist got really, really pissed off, and the other scientist said something like, okay, now prove to me that you're really pissed off. You could be a machine pretending to be pissed off. Prove it to me. So, you know, that struck a chord there. You know, I read it in my childhood and I was awestruck about the concept. So that's one thing, you know, us treating other people as if they are sometimes interesting pieces of machinery. That's one thing. And the other thing is, I'm also, among other things, I'm a musician and I'm a sound technician. So I know the kind of detail that many people in this kind of occupation put into doing the right thing, into connecting the equipment, the exact kind of equipment in exactly the right way, putting the exact parameters into each and every piece of equipment, or these days into each and every plugin and piece of software. And sometimes when you're so into that, you forget that the goal of all that thing is the human voice, you know, to transmit the human voice. And do you remember that there was that song by Cher, I think? Do you believe that? Do you believe? You
remember
that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember that song, yeah.
So that song uses makes heavy use of a pitch corrector.
Oh.
Which changes the pitch of the singer as he or she sings, you know? So yeah. At one point, under all these effects and pieces of equipment, how much humanity is left? You know.
Yeah.
And of course, the Japanese already have a completely virtual singer by now.
Yeah, I saw that. That was cool and creepy at the same time.
Yeah, right. That's exactly what I thought, you know. Cool and creepy. I mean, I wish I could be a virtual singer.
And now they're bringing back dead singers. They brought back, was it Tupac? They made a digital representation of Tupac at some concert.
Yeah, that was also, you know, I mean, I have no problem with progress. I have no problem with that. It's not, I have no problem, you know. I mean, if you could bring back Frank Sinatra, or if you could bring back Elvis, or whoever it is, be my guest, the Beatles, I'd buy that for a dollar. But still, it makes you think. That's what I'm trying to do. I mean, that's what I'm doing. That's what I'm trying to deliver, you know.
Just thinking about what all of this technology means for what it means to then be human.
Yeah, but it's what humans make of technology, I'd say. Mm. It's so easy. You know, I make a living as a computer programmer. So it's so easy to get drawn into that world, you know, and never come out again.
Yeah.
You know, you get sucked by your inside by your computer, and that's what you do. You can spend days without actual interaction with another human being if you're not careful.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And it kind of links up to, I mean, I know we're talking about Cinders when he brought up these questions, but even the story that I mentioned finding rather amusing, the Vegascan story, in which the main character is a vegetarian and they're going on a fact-finding mission to discover whether or not there's intelligent life on this other planet. And so they all get into this machine, then they fly off, and he has this veggie scan, which can tell you whether or not something is made of meat. And I do find it really interesting because he becomes so reliant on this machine, to the point where there are times when he won't eat things, even though the machine may be malfunctioning, and he relies so much on this machine without recognizing that there are points when it could actually be wrong, and ends up, of course, almost going slightly mad. And there's humorous moments of how his madness progresses. I won't ruin them. But I mean, there is that sense too of, you know, that the human beings become reliant on machines in not necessarily good ways, sometimes in good ways, like, you know, someone with a pacemaker is reliant on a machine, but that's to keep their heart going. But in his case, he's obsessed with his machine, in a way that's very detrimental, I think, to his psyche.
Yeah. That's one thing I thought of, you know, because relying on machine, I've been relying on machines all my life. I've been programming computers since I was about 9 years old. You know, now with smartphones and all that kind of stuff. But what I, in this particular case, except for, you know, the fun of having three men on a boat in space, which is, yeah, I love Jerome K. Jerome, by the way. It's just such a great inspiration. So except for that, my thoughts were about the belief in machines. When I was a child, we had a computer, and my brother and I would play computer games in it, and my brother started developing all sorts of theories as to why he was winning or losing the game at any given point. Theories about stuff which could not have been, you know, about, I don't know, the weather interrupting, or if you do that kind of thing, exactly that kind of movement with the joystick, which couldn't have been noticed by the computer because the joysticks were really simple. You know, it's not, we're talking here about the 80s. For a little while, I believed in his theories as well. And it got to my mind that it's so easy to believe in something, in a machine, in something which you know is mechanical and simple, and yet you believe in it. And we do that, I think, from childhood. I mean, little children may believe in their teddy bear, stuff like that. Mm. So many grown-ups still believe in, you know, in many things which have no real connection to reality. So that's my take on that.
Yeah, and then in this particular case, it's direct reliance on a machine which even the character recognizes can be recalibrated numerous times, which I found really funny. Is anytime they think that the machine is malfunctioning, like he points the machine at the one of the characters' hot dogs, and it tells him it's not meat, it's perfectly safe to eat. I did find that rather, just the humor in it was just really fun, just the kind of the ways in which the machine malfunctions.
Well, thanks. It's again the kind of humor which really appeals to me, which is present in many of the books I read, such as again Three Men in a Boat and some East European literature, which I like. I'm really glad that you liked it and that you found it funny, because much of my humor, so it was, you know, so people told me, has a bit of East European or Russian feeling to it. So I can always, I'm never sure whether an American or an Englishman will get the, you know,
get the humor.
They'll find it funny. So, well, I'm really happy now.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, the people in the West may describe many of your stories as being darkly humorous, like what we would refer to as black comedy. Because this one in particular, we're talking about Veggie Scan, I think that one's more conventionally humorous, in the sense that, I mean, I could just imagine it as like a sitcom episode. you know, like an episode of Seinfeld or something, just kind of that very direct humor. But other stories are humorous in a rather dark way, I think. I mean, take, for example, the Word of God. Mostly all the stories I'm talking about are the early ones. I want to save a lot of the other stuff for people to read on their own. But like the Word of God, the way it's written is a series of – they're all connected events, but they're out-of-context events. They're usually based on dialogue. And it's set in a world or part of our history in which anything people say that they desire or presumably desire comes true. And that includes all of the really, really evil stuff that people wish for but really shouldn't wish for. So, I mean, there's moments in the story where entire peoples just disappear. And even one of there's an amusing moment where this fellow doesn't like, I think it's his mother or something, someone upstairs. He doesn't like all the people of this one family, and it turns out that a member of his own family is a part of that family. And so he gets rid of that entire family and accidentally gets rid of someone of his own family. And on the one hand, that's really disturbing. But on the other, it's actually ironically hilarious. It's that kind of dark humor. I mean, here's somebody who's basically destroying people altogether. And that's one of those stories where it's just kind of dark, but yet funny at the same time.
Yeah, well, that's my that's one strong thing. I mean, there is a main theme to the collection, but one of the other things that runs along it is belief. So if we had in Vegascan, we had a guy who believes in this, you know, cranky device. Here it's almost all about belief, about the belief of the people. And what happens if what you say, by the way, it's not what they wish for, not in the beginning, it's what they say.
Yeah.
You just say, you know, if someone says to that man, you're a dog, then this person becomes a dog. Only in the second part of the story, they begin to utilize that. And I find, to me, the concept of God, of at least of the particular God which we have in the three monotheistic religions, is... Well, I wish I could say stupid, but it's more offensive, you know. The belief that people put in that kind of thing, the belief that someone takes care of us instead of, you know, go and take care of yourself, I don't like it. I think it's not so much funny as it is dangerous. And I mean, see how many wars you have because of religion. That's nothing. I'm saying nothing new here. And in my country, religion is a big issue. I mean, it gets. I mean, someone like me should be living without any connection to religion. But still, much of the food you buy here has to be kosher. Which makes it sometimes more expensive, sometimes less tasty. So, okay, you can get in Tel Aviv anything you want. And actually, I brag, and justly so, that food in Tel Aviv is much better than in most European capitals and in most of the U.S. Especially, by the way, what is that thing with the tomatoes? I have no idea how you people eat the tomatoes they they sell in the supermarket. I kid you not. I mean, I went to New York once, and I made the mistake of buying a tomato in the supermarket, and it was huge, and it was red, just like a new Corvette car, and it tasted just like cardboard. I was amazed. I mean, how do you do that?
I mean, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, we do have a big problem. I mean, with such a large country, getting much of the produce that we eat to...
I think that's actually genetic engineering at work, making the product have a longer shelf life, but less taste, because who cares?
Well, part of it is probably that too, but also, I mean, when you're in somewhere like New York, where not as much farming is done, they likely ship those tomatoes from the Midwest, but they shipped them before they were actually ripe, because they ship for a long time, so they get them when they're... You really shouldn't pick them so that they become ripe by the time they get there. That's my assumption. It's a little bit different when you're nearer the farming communities, because they don't have to treat...
Yeah, that's probably why in California it wasn't like that. In California, they had good food. Okay, so anyway, we were talking about belief.
But yeah. it's an interesting point, you know, the ways in which our technology has changed how we get access to our produce. Because I bet you 100 years ago, that was not how you got your produce. You probably got most of your produce from locally grown farms, or at least state-grown farms. Here now we get our produce from, I get California produce in Florida. And that, in a way that doesn't make any sense, because I'm so near the Midwest, but... Whatever. Yeah. But anyway, sorry.
Yeah. So, the produce that I get is relatively fresh, because Israel is such a small country. We're talking about most of Israel is concentrated in about 500 kilometers of length, and about 100 kilometers of width, and that's about it. So it's rather small, so everything is fresh. Anyway, belief.
Yeah.
Did I say everything that I had to say about belief? Now I fail to remember.
You were kind of discussing, you had an issue with the way in which, the three monotheistic religions, the Abrahamic religions, perceive a God that, yeah.
So, well, of course, the really bad guy here is not God, but is organized religion.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I don't really have to explain why it's bad. Everyone knows why it's bad, and everyone who doesn't agree won't be convinced by anything I say, because belief is part of his equation. So if you... I don't think that you can that anyone who doesn't believe can think of one good reason why organized religion is a good thing, because it isn't. I'm even a bit bitter about that.
Do you think that has something to do with where you are in the world? I mean, that has had an influence, perhaps?
Oh, of course. Of course, because organized religion has much influence on the life of an Israeli. For example, we don't have public transport on the Shabbos, on the Sabbath. We just, you know, no buses. That's it. Many stores are closed. That's it. And there's a law against that kind of thing, and religious people, the organized religious. Oh, by the way, you cannot get married in any other way in Israel. The only way to get married is in a religion way. Otherwise, it's not it's not recognized by the state.
That's really fascinating.
Now, what you can do is you can take your spouse, go to another country, marry there, get back to Israel, and then it will be recognized. But you cannot perform such a ceremony inside Israel. It will not be recognized. That's it.
That seems completely pointless, because if you can leave the country, and many Israelis do, they do go abroad, and you can get married there in any way you see fit, and it'll recognize it. It seems like it's a pointless law.
Oh, there are many such pointless laws.
I guess that's normal for any country, though, to have pointless laws.
I will give you another example, which will be much more interesting to you, maybe. It is forbidden to grow pigs on Israeli soil. So, what do? They don't grow them on the ground. They have platforms on which they put the pigs. And that's how they grow pigs, and it's still legal.
I just don't, like, because I understand why they have the law about you can't grow pigs on Israeli soil. I mean, if you're Jewish, you don't eat pig, but...
No, but I am Jewish and I do eat pig and I kind of like eating pig, you know?
Well, I mean, if you're someone practicing the faith in which you're not supposed to eat pig, is what I mean.
But why should I be influenced? This is, you know, 2013.
Oh, I agree completely. It's just such a silly, like, if you didn't want pig in the country, why would you make a rule that says you can't have it on soil? Why didn't you just say pigs are not allowed in Israel at all?
Yeah, well, lucky me.
Well, it just seems like somebody didn't think it through.
Yeah, just don't be so loud when you say that. Someone might hear you.
Will I get hit?
And then I'll be deprived of my breakfast. And so, yeah, I like bacon. So you're influenced by religion. There are many laws, there's much more, you know. I can get really political here, but I don't think we should go into that.
Sure.
But suffice to say that religion, I think, is a bad influence on the world in general, not only the Jewish religion or the Christian religion. I think that the world would be a much better place without religion, or with religion taught as something, you know, some exotic thing that once existed, and that, you know, no one does that anymore. I know it's a dream, you know.
It comes down to the question of, you know, that when we're talking religion, we mean it's outward public form. I mean, if somebody were to believe whatever they want to believe in the comfort of their own home, that doesn't affect anybody else. It's the... When religious belief imposes itself on other people, whatever that religious belief happens to be, it could be any belief. But as soon as it begins to impose, and this seems to be the fundamental problem that you're having. Yeah.
Actually, fundamentalism is the fundamental problem.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you there. I definitely agree.
So I think the Word of God talks about that. And I had a story. I don't think it's in the connection, the collection. I once wrote a story about some scientists who, by mistakes, comes upon a gas which causes anyone to lose their religious belief. Anyone who breathes, inhales the gas, immediately loses everything belief-wise. It's a really short story. Maybe I should translate it one day.
That would be really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's similar to I teach literature, and I taught a story called A Sojourn in the City of Amalgamation, and it's in the early 1800s, and this white American who was against the idea of freeing the slaves, and so he writes this story in which we've managed to solve slavery by these mystical processes, is similar to like a gas, but it's they call it boiling, where they stick you in a vat and this giant monster person puts stuff on you, and then suddenly you're okay with other people of other colors. There's a kind of similarity of that change. Granted, it's a different political argument, but
that's an interesting one.
Yeah.
I never heard of it, I admit, but I'd be interested in reading it.
Yeah, you can only find two chapters online. I have looked everywhere for the full book, and I can't find it anywhere.
Oh, that's a pity.
Yeah, it's probably buried in an archive somewhere, but...
Yeah, some university or something.
Yeah, but it is a fascinating story, and for the time, but that would be really cool if you did translate that, so...
Yeah, I should. It's not too long. Maybe I should.
Awesome. Well, let me know if you do it, because I'll happily read it. So,
sure. There's a story. There's another story dealing with religion that I did translate, which is in the book. What's the name in English now? I don't remember. I never remember the names of the stories in English. Because I wrote them in Hebrew.
Was it The Believers?
Yeah, The Believers. Okay. Right. So I think that story shows you really my my idea about religion and about God. I think that if God was to manifest in some earthly way in the here and now, if it wasn't an abstract concept, but you know, you get the real rules of God as they appear in the Bible. And by the way, I have read the Bible several times.
Sure.
I'm not talking out of ignorance here. I kind of like the Bible, by the way. Just, you know, as fiction. If you had the God of the Bible in the here and now, it would be intolerable. It would be horrible. It would be cruel beyond belief. I mean, if you read the Bible, you'll find horrible things happening. And that's what I try to convey in that particular story, in The Believers, in which people, in which God invades our own reality, and people get so desperate that some of them try to kill him.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. There's actually a series of books by James Morrow, mm-hmm. in which the physical manifestation of God, that is he's this giant being, and I think in the first book, I think it's called Towing Jehovah, God actually dies, and they have this giant festering corpse, and they don't know what to do with it, so they decide to tow it out to sea and sink it. And so, I mean, that's kind of related to kind of what you're suggesting here about, you know, people who get so, they find it so intolerable they have to kill him. Well, what do you then do with a dead God?
Yeah, well, I actually didn't have the physical body of God in the story. I had sure. only the only his angels, who are quite horrible by themselves, and the fact that you get some sort, I don't want to give out too much, but this is also a bit of story about rape, and I don't take that lightly.
No,
I'm not using that. I mean, if I didn't think that, if I didn't feel that strongly about the subject, and if I didn't think that there was a real comparison, because to me, in a way, religious belief is a sort of a, let's call it, brain rape.
Those are strong words.
I have met my share. You know, I have served in the Israeli army. I've served in the IDF. And I didn't do any fighting or anything of the sort. Hmm. But the thing is about the IDF, the good thing actually, is that you get to meet people who you usually won't meet. People who are of different, let's say, social economic background. People who come from places you've never known about. And many of those were really heavy believers. Hmm. And you could see that many of their actions and many of their decisions were guided so forcefully by the belief in God that it defied all logic, and sometimes they were acting on the verge of being dangerous to themselves and to others because of that. So I'm not talking about, you know, like someone who's, you know, just sitting in my flat thinking to myself, oh, I don't like that God person. No, it's not to my taste. I'm talking about real life experience here.
And it would be a very different, and I think that's going to be something that I think most of our audience will be an American audience, and they may find some of what you're saying about religion very difficult, mostly because the U.S. is such a religious country. But they have to understand that from the experiences that you've had, being in Israel, I mean, you're confronted by two different sides of the sort of religious aisle. These experiences you're talking about now, having served in the military, and have experienced people who are so fervent in their beliefs that they actually become dangerous. And then, of course, you know, you live in Israel, and let's face it, almost every year there is some sort of conflict as a result either of whatever the government has done or what someone has done in response to Israel, or directly just to Israel and not in direct response to something. I mean, just think, there the tensions just ramped up again between Israel and Palestine. And I don't think...
But that's, by the way, that's not the thing I'm talking about, because I think the conflict between Israel and Palestine is much less religious than some people would lead us to believe. It's a conflict about land. It's not a simple one. It's not an easy one. It's a problem. It's a really, really difficult problem. And I am... I don't think that I, in particular, have the solution. I mean, I think they should have their own country, but you know, who listens to me? But I think that this doesn't have much to do with religion. I'm talking, my experience with religious people is with Jewish fanatics. So I've actually never met a Muslim fanatic. I mean, I know they exist, but I've never met one. I met Jewish fanatics, so that's what my experience relies on. When I say, by the way, that I met religious fanatics, I mean that when I was in basic training in the army, I was serving in I was doing it with a bunch of people who came from a religious school. And these guys, they had, how do you call it? When you get to the army, you get what we call a profile. You get a number which says basically how healthy you are. Okay. I don't know how your American call it. So we were all on the low side of the healthiness. I, because I happen to have asthma, and they, because they had deep psychological problems. And what happened was that one of them, that was at the time of the first Gulf War. We're talking 91 here. So Israel was attacked by Iraq remotely by missiles. Now, before the actual attacks, Israel was threatened. There was an ultimatum, I think the ultimatum was actually towards the United States, that they should retreat, which they didn't. So at that particular time, I was in basic training, and one of the religious guys there organized a group prayer to pray for everyone that we will be safe by the missiles, and I failed to comply. And in return, he took his personal weapon and tried to shoot me. That's a real story.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So that showed me, I was 18 at the time, and that gave me a real good taste of what a religion person can do if you get too close to his religion. Now, I'm not saying that every religious person is a fanatic, and I'm far from it. That's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about limits. I'm talking about the places that you can get if you get too deep, if you get too involved.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think in this respect I know what I'm talking about. So I think the terms I'm using are strong. I know that, but
they come from a personal experience.
Justified,
yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah, and an experience I think most Americans will never experience, but have to maybe understand that when you're confronted with that kind of, I'm just going to call it madness, because that's what that is. That's pure madness. When that's your, I mean, and I think, I mean, there was even the example in the United States, and I know this has now become like the political podcast, but I think it is relevant to your work here. I mean, recently in the United States, there was the furor over the well, it didn't happen in the United States. The furor occurred in Libya and other countries in the area over this that video, the anti-Muslim video, and the response being, you know, well, this video was made and we're now just going to kill because you've offended our religion. And that because and just to be clear, not all Muslims think like this. Most Muslims don't. They look at that and they go, look, I completely disagree with it. I abhor, you know, representations of the Prophet because it's against my religion, but I'm not going to run around threatening to kill people. And yet that's the kind of fanaticism you're describing. I mean, but even for something even more mundane, you just didn't want to observe the religious practice. And his response is to try to shoot you. Like, wow.
Yeah, I'm actually, the reason I'm alive is because he forgot about the safety pin. Otherwise, it was an M16 rifle, and he put it on, how do you say it, when he doesn't shoot only one bullet, but...
automatic?
Yeah, he put it on automatic, and it was loaded at everything, you know, it was quite crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. So... And I'm saying, what I am saying is that many times organized religion in its struggle to gain power goes to extremism. And extremism is not good. That's basically what I'm trying to say.
Well, and based on those kinds of examples, I mean, yeah, when the response is basically to commit murder, and I mean, this is an individual presumably that believes murder is wrong.
Yeah, that was someone. Look, he was crazy. You can, I mean, I have to admit that I have no way to know what kind of a person he would have been were it not for religion. But I think he'd have less reasons to kill me.
Possibly. Well, in particularly this case, because your refusal to observe would not have become the impetus for the attempted murder. So.
Yeah, actually, what happened was I did not say I will not come. I said something like, "Oh yeah, sure, you go and do that, and I'll join you. Just give me a couple of minutes, you know." And I was probably too relaxed when I say that.
Then it doesn't help make him seem any less sane. No.
Yeah.
It just makes it even worse. But
yeah.
So okay, let's jump back really quick to just talk a little bit more about the work. Though this is a very fascinating discussion, I don't want to overwhelm the audience with it. So let's talk about one of my favorite stories, which is my uncle gave me a time machine.
Oh.
which is another one of those darkly humorous stories in which a kid is given this strange record for his birthday, and that record, when you play it, it takes you back in time at 2-minute intervals. And of course, because he happens to have a computer, he decides, well, since I figured I can go back in time, I'll just sample the song into the computer and then play it really, really, really fast. And then he ends up going back in time to well before he was born. And then it's his attempt basically to either get back or to keep history the same as it was so that he can still exist. And all the kind of really, really terrifying things that he does in the service of that idea. And I just find it really interesting, you know, that this attempt on humanity's part to control its own history. And in this case, this child becomes a man who desperately wants to return and finds that he can't and has to take hold of his own future, essentially. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about kind of where this story came from in a way.
Well, one of the things I wanted to deal with that particular story is that the way people tell history.
Mm-hmm.
History is always told from the side of the not the winners, but the current, I don't know, government. I like reading history books. So when I But disliking, I mean, I've been reading history books for about, I don't know, 15 years now. So there were several years in of my life, being an adult, actually believing the history that I was told at school, which was very inaccurate, is not a strong enough word to describe it. And which was, of course, always on the Jewish/Israeli side. We were always the good guys. We were surrounded always by horrible enemies. Now, some of it is true, but many things are not. And the telling of the history, this is a guy who goes back into the kind of history that he was told about by his mother, by his grandfather. And one of the key things here to an Israeli, mostly to an Israeli reader, is that all the history that he was told by his grandfather, which he tries to use on the grandfather when he comes back in time, in order to convince the grandfather that he knows about him, all this is a lie.
That's right. I remember that. It's not true.
And so he tells the grandfather all the right things, all the things that his grandfather told him when he was smaller. And his grandfather immediately says, "What a bunch of crap is that?" and throws him out of the house. And that's a key moment for me.
And it happens many times.
He throws him out of the house many times, but only one time because of these particular stories, which he tries to tell him. We were always, as Israelis, you get several. It's like for Americans, you get told about the Mayflower. And about the Civil War, and about Lincoln. And it's, as a student, as a school pupil, it's a bit of a given, right? I mean, when you're a little child, no one will tell you anything bad about Lincoln, I guess.
No, as a general rule, not, no.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know if there is anything really horribly wrong about Lincoln. So I'm just giving it to you as an example, because he's such a, you know, such a famous figure, such an essential figure in American history. So you should think of as an example. Suppose that Lincoln was, say, a vampire, and no one told you about it. Okay, so and no one ever mentioned it, and at school, and then you grow up, and one day you find out that yeah, he was a vampire. You know, I'm just giving a silly example.
Sure, sure.
But that was about the kind of impact that one gets when he studies in an Israeli school. And then he goes out into the world and reads some better history, some real history. So that was one aspect of the story. Another aspect of the story is the actual song itself. The song, you see, preceded the story. It exists.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Actually, it was my first album, which is in Hebrew. Is called The Universe in a Pita. You know, pita bread?
Yeah.
And it contains rock and roll science fiction songs. And one of the songs is called My Uncle Gave Me Time Machine. And it lasts 2 minutes 32, which is, I think, what I wrote in the story. And what happens in the song is that it's actually the description in the story is correct. That's the song. Only the rhyming is better because it's in Hebrew. So, you know, it works better.
Yeah.
And then when I created the album's sleeve, the graphics, I had some fun and I put a minus sign in front of the 2 minutes 32. And that's where the original seed of the story came from.
That's so, I had no idea. And now that I know, that's really funny.
Yeah, it's a silly song. The problem is there are really some parts in the songs which are played in reverse. But I guess to an American, it won't mean much because you don't know Hebrew, so you don't get when it's forward and when it's reverse.
Fair enough. Yeah, maybe a little bit difficult.
Yeah.
that's so cool because I had no idea that this is a story that in some sense was based on a real event in your life and the creation of this song. And that's great. That totally changes. So is your band called Pita Morgana too?
That particular band was called Pita Morgana. Yeah.
that's fantastic. Oh, that's great. We're kind of about to close out here. So, where can folks expect? What can folks expect from you in the next year? Since you've now released this particular collection at the end of last year. Clearly, you're still writing, and I'm guessing working on music, etc. So, do you have more stuff that we can expect in the future?
Well, what I'm doing now is actually I'm working on my second short film. I created a short film about 2 years ago, which went on to be screened at the Sci-Fi London Film Festival.
Oh, cool!
And so now I'm working on my second short film, which involves a time machine, strangely enough. It's about a guy who builds a time machine out of a microwave oven in his kitchen, and his roommate is really not happy about that at all. and the machine is supposed to take him only several hours into the future, which it does, and then he's so happy about it that he says something like, small step for men or a giant step to mankind, and using only microwave oven, and he just taps the microwave, he touches the microwave oven, and the microwave oven goes poof, and from that moment on, every 20 seconds, the microwave oven jumps 6 hours into the future. And he gets stuck in this, you know, jumping all the time.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's going to be a really nice film. We're shooting it at the end of February. So that's one thing I'm doing. Another thing I'm doing is I'm writing a novel on my own, which also somehow involves a time machine. What happened to me?
You're obsessed.
It's really, I think it's a coincidence. So this particular novel, the work title is King Solomon's Time Machine. And in which there's an old Jewish legend about King Solomon who captures Samedi, you know, the head of the devils in... Okay. Jewish mythology, Samedi, I'm not sure how you say that in English. I think it's Samedi. So he captures Samedi and he tells all the legends about King Solomon begin in a similar way. The first sentence you get says how smart and amazing and incredibly wise Solomon is. The second sentence has Solomon do something really, really dumb. So in this particular case, Solomon, the smartest man in history, etc., asks Samedi, he says to Samedi, look, you're the king of the devils and I'm just a human, but I captured you. So how are you better than me? So Samedi says, give me your ring, your... How do you call it? Royal ring? The ring of, you know, of his kingdom. I've no idea how to say that. Poor Solomon gives him the ring, and somebody goes on and swallows it and throws Solomon 400 miles and sits on his throne, takes his form, and governs in his place. And Solomon now goes all over the land as a beggar and says to everyone, I was Solomon, I was king of Jerusalem, and no one believes him. So I took that legend, and one day I love that legend. So one day it occurred to me, what would happen if Solomon got thrown 400 miles into the future? And that's how it started. So I have Solomon as this kind of wandering Jew, sort of. Of course, he doesn't know that he's a Jew, because the term Jew was not invented yet.
That's a good point.
You know that the term Jew doesn't exist in the Bible, except for in the how do you call that in English? Except in a really late, very late tale. It doesn't exist because it's the name. It comes from the name of Judah. And that's the people were not. They were called the sons of Israel in the Bible.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
So Solomon, the first time Solomon hears the word Jew, he's really amazed. He says, "Well, are you talking to me? what's that you're talking about?" But in any way, at one point, Solomon gets to the second temple. Solomon was the one who built the first temple. And he gets to the area of the second temple, the one built by King Herod. And what happens is that he gets mad. He loses his mind in grief and in amazement, because everything he did got wiped out. And someone erected a bigger temple. So he loses his mind, and he goes berserk, and he goes into the yard of the temple, and he starts shouting about the sins of people. And because the times being what they are, people start following him, thinking that he's some kind of a seer or prophet. And as you may have guessed, he ends this episode on the cross with a nice sign of King of the Jews above him.
Oh, okay.
Now, the interesting thing is that, you know, in Christianity, Jesus is believed to be a descendant of King David. And Solomon is the direct son of King David. So it all fits.
Oh, that's really weird.
and not only that, but he has a ring. He exchanges rings with Samadhi. So the ring he has is a sort of a time machine. So that's how he gets off the cross. He just jumps.
Oh, that's going to be really interesting.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. it's actually quite a complex story to write, because there is actually much more in it than what I've just said, including the fact that the narrator is, in the first tense, is Solomon, who lives today in some part of Jerusalem, and tells about himself in the third person.
Oh.
So yeah, it's a bit of a complex work. Been working on it for some time now. Hope to finish one day. So that's that. And otherwise, other than that, there's just, you know, bits and pieces.
Yeah.
You know, And I do some small video projects. I mean, have you seen the robots video that I made for the book?
No, I missed it.
Ah, that's a pity. Well, okay. if you go to my site, which is very conveniently called nirianiv.com, and for your listeners, I would say that's nirianiv.com. I have that. I have a really nice short video with really charming toy robots, which I made for my collection, which I think you'll like.
That's gonna be cool. Yeah, I'll go check that out and make sure everybody knows about it when I put up the show notes. Fantastic. Cool. So new movie. You're working on a book, and people can go to nirianiv.com, Nir Yaniv. So that's
right.
And I'll put a link up on the site for that. So thanks so much for taking the time and rescheduling a bunch of times for this interview. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Cool. So everybody go check out his stuff, buy his collection. If you don't, I'll cry. So, but definitely go check it out, and I'll see everybody next time. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.